she with your daughter? She's a lawyer too?
No, she's a lobbyist.
Oh, what kind of lobbyist?
Mostly for banks and insurance companies and things like that. Sometimes real estate interests. Where are we?
Have you gone to an inauguration yourself?
It's been a long time. I've been there several times.
Judge Schwartz, can you describe the city of Pittsburgh and your growing up here?
Well, there's been tremendous changes, and in my growing up years, of course, it was rather a dirty place. Shirts were changed 3 times a day. The mills were humming. People would come out of the mills in Oakland. I mean, the smoke would come up and dirty everybody's clean awnings or should take curtains and drapes and things like that. It was a dismal sort of a place. But having always lived in Squirrel Hill, a little bit above all the dirt and grime, we never really noticed it too badly. We were sort of escaped that part of Pittsburgh. Of course, there was all streetcars back in those days. There was no airplanes. I used to love to go to New York by the old Pittsburgh train that left at 10 o'clock and get on the train at 10. Go into the club car. What was like Lewis Kaplan, the eminent Pittsburgh dean of the lawyers. We'd sit there and talk until all hours of the night. Before you know it, we'd go to bed and get up and we'd be in New York City. And Pittsburgh was a vibrant town after the Depression. It was a lot of things were active. Gulf Oil was big. Aluminum Company was big. The banks, we had lots of banks before the Depression. Of course, Mellon always was a big bank. The Dollar Savings Bank was always a revered institution, as was, which is now Pittsburgh National. It's the Fidelity Trust Company, was a favorite of the lawyers and so forth and so on, as Potter Bank was. It was a town with great numbers of financial institutions. Of course, Heinz was always the backbone and the background of the community. Labor came into its own during the Depression years when the members who had worked and were laid off and things like that decided that they had to unionize, and this was the beginning of Mr. Murray and the unions and the big stride that the working people of this country made during the Depression years. Pittsburgh was at the hum of it, right at the beginning of all the problems. It was a dynamic place. Great changes from that time. Of course, there's always a great cleavage between the rich and the poor in Pittsburgh, and to be utterly frank, between the Jew and the Gentile. Back in those days, there were very few Jews that were accepted in Gentile society. They tell a favorite story about one of the country clubs out in Penn Hills that overlooked a great stretch of land, and some of the Jewish veterans of Pittsburgh, like Marcus Aaron, fellows like that, were invited to play golf. And I said, why don't you invite us to become a member of your club? I said, well, we have a policy. And so as they were playing, they saw this, what they thought was a beautiful tract of land, which they went out and bought, and that became the Westmoreland Country Club. But they were encouraged to do this to keep the Jews out of the local country clubs. And it's probably so today. very few Jews belonged to Osborne Temple. Who is that?
Your brother.
Tell him I'll call him back. Tell him I'm being interviewed.
Okay.
One more? Well, they, of course, before World War II, there was a real cleavage in Jewish society. There was the so-called German Jews who considered themselves a step ahead of other types of Jews. And one of the problems that my father had, he didn't exactly cotton to German Jews and refused admittance to the, he wouldn't join the Concordia Club and other places like that. Because he didn't like their tactics. That's what he went out soliciting money for the Polish Jews and the other European Jews. They wouldn't give him any money. And it's only since the event of Hitler and the Holocaust that they brought the thing together. But back in the, before the Holocaust, the German Jews went their way and the rest of the Jews went on a completely different way. A lot of people would deny the accuracy of that statement. But if you read any histories about Jews in America, you'll see that what I'm saying is right.
Did it have to do with finances as well as origin?
Well, basically, sure. The German Jew came to America in 1840, 1850. If you read Our Crowd, they took their packs and they went all through the country. And before you know it, they became either merchants or ended up in Wall Street as investment bankers and things like that. And of course, they had 20, 30, 40 year head start on great numbers of other Jewish people in the country or the community. And it was, to a great extent, based on several things. There were some cultural differences. Some of them were better educated. The Jews that came from Germany had the advantage of the German educational system, which was an improvement over the educational system of the Southern European Jews. And also they were more affluent, and people took better care of them, and they integrated them at a higher degree than the other Jews. It took longer. The real progress of the Jew came with the event of World War II. You can almost name through the leaders. I mean, if you look back 30, 40 years, a lot of them are families who are just getting off the boat.
When it came to culture and recreation within the city and Jewish community, could you name some of the clubs or organizations that maybe one group belonged
sure,
to
the
other?
Sure. For example, one of the big tragedies in Pittsburgh, in my mind, was when they eliminated the swimming pool at the Rhoda Sholem Synagogue. Remember that?
No, I didn't know.
Oh, that's where we used to go. There was a Mr. Taylor who was an Olympic swimming coach who ran the pool at the temple. And during the summer months, we would go down there every day swimming. And they had a gymnasium on the top floor. And they had dancing classes that we'd attend in the gymnasiums and the swimming pool. And it was a real recreational facility. Then they had a place called the Mercantile Club, which was on Beacon Street in Pittsburgh, where a great number of Jewish families would play tennis and then have their meals there on the weekends. And there's a place to go on the Saturdays and Sundays. They have movies for the families and things like that. It was a pleasant experience. In addition, of course, you had the Concordia Club, the Lisbon Country Club. Later on, you had other Jewish clubs.
And then the advent of World War II came. You had just graduated from law school. And what happened to you in 1940?
I got drafted in 42.
Okay.
I was admitted to the bar December 13, 1940. And I started practicing law down in this building in room 408. And believe it or not, I was starting to be successful.
What was the law firm you were affiliated
with? I was with an individual called the name of Robert Averbach. But I had my own shingle, my own practice. The first year of practice, I had 8 or 9 estates, which was unusual for a young lawyer. And was starting to do fairly well for a fellow that never worked and never had made any money before. And then Uncle Sam decided it was my time to go. So in, I guess it was May 13, 1942, I was drafted and sent down to Camp Shelby in Mississippi. Before I knew it, I was in North Africa. And I got mixed up with the 1st Infantry Division. And fortunately for me, this first day I was there, they had to send 400 or 500 men to the Anzio beachhead. And they kept me for some unforeseen reason. And, I stayed with the 1st Division, went to Sicily and through that campaign. I went up to England, made the invasion of France, and went all through France, into Germany, into Czechoslovakia. Then I became a high point man, and I was dismissed from the service in June of 1945. I should say my father died June 7, 1945. Shortly thereafter, I was sent home.
I'm very ignorant when it comes to all of this, so I'm going to take you back a little bit. And when you said you joined the infantry, you were actually one of the fighting members?
I don't want to give you the impression that I did all the fighting. I was, because of my legal background, I ended up in what they call the service company. And I ran what they call the courts and boards sections. In Sicily, I was appointed. I was assigned to the 1st Infantry Division, the 16th Infantry. And I was sent over to the courts and boards, which is court martials and line of duty boards and other things of great importance to the Army. And I was sent over to work with a fellow by the name of Clark, Jim Clark. And I was there for about 20 minutes when Clark said he doesn't feel well. He's going on sick call. So I said, okay. He says, look smart. He says, that's all they want you to do around here. So I looked smart for a few hours when I get word that Clark had been evacuated to North Africa with yellow jaundice or something like that. And the next morning I was put in charge of the courts and boards. And I had the distinct pleasure of handling hundreds and hundreds of court martials along the duty boards. And before you know it, I was the big man in that particular field. But you learn fast in the Army, or you didn't survive.
And then you said you went through France?
Well, I went from Sicily. We were 3 weeks on board a ship going through Gibraltar. And we were under submarine attack the entire route. And I think at one time we were practically in New York Harbor. It was the British Highlander Division, the United States 1st Infantry Division, and the 3rd United States Infantry Division. We were all taken from Sicily to England. But because of the submarines, they diverted us all around the ocean. But I was fortunate. I was visiting with all my worked on board the ship, so I had sort of an exalted visit on the ship.
And then where were you when you were discharged? Once you went?
Well, no, I went to England, and then we were stationed in the little town of Bridport, on the southern coast. And our prime duty there was getting troops ready for the invasion. And that was all of southern England was an area, let's say it's a staging area for the invasion. There would be maneuvers and things like that. But they were really staging the soldiers that were coming in from all over the world, not only the American soldiers, but the Canadian troops as well. And after a while, it became quite apparent that we were getting ready for the big show. And sooner or later, that big show began.
When you went to the continent.
What's that?
Then you were on, you went to the continent from, and when the war was over, where were you?
Czechoslovakia. Hoth, Czechoslovakia, H-O-L. We had gone all through France, Germany, through Luxembourg, and ended up in Czechoslovakia.
Before I get to the Holocaust, let me ask you, were there that many court-martials?
Yes. There was. For example, one of my favorite cases was a man from Pittsburgh by the name of Preswellack.
Could you spell that?
I couldn't.
Okay.
This time, spell it.
It's Preswellack?
He was from the south side of Pittsburgh. I remember it vividly. Before our outfit left from the States to England, to jump ship. They finally got him back into England. Before the outfit left to North Africa, he jumped ship again. And they got him in Africa. He jumped ship in Africa before the Sicilian came. Finally, we got him back in England, and the last I heard, he was given something like 170 years of disciplinary training center. I believe it was 1913. We used to have out a lot of time. They didn't serve that time. They would go there, and then they would commute their sentence, so they would be sent to the front.
I had no idea. And then you said when you were released from the service, you were at High Point.
I was what they call a high point man.
Okay, and what is that?
High point. Back in those days, if you had 85 points or more, you were eligible to be discharged at the end of the European War. Those with less points were scheduled to go to the Pacific to get involved in the Japanese. So I had enough points that I was eligible to be discharged at the end of the European War. So I came home and I was discharged in July of 45.
How did you gain the points?
Time in the service and the campaigns. You got so many points for every campaign, you got so many points for every month of service.
Judge Schwartz, were you aware while you were in the service, were you aware of what was happening to the Jews again?
That's an interesting question. I was and I wasn't. But when I was in England, which I was there for quite a while before the invasion, you'd hear very few rumbles, but nothing concrete. My first awareness was when I was in Germany. And when I became cognizant of what was going on, it was one night after dinner. We were served in mess kits. And we always had plenty of food. And there was always a tremendous amount of garbage. At least we made it into garbage. One night, as I was emptying my mess kit, I saw just maybe 100 bedraggled human beings who were grabbing the mess kits before we could throw it into the garbage and eating out of the mess kits. And making a few inquiries, I found out that they had come from the camps.
Where in Germany was this?
I'm just not sure.
Can you put a time on that?
What's that?
Can you tell us the dates of, you
know? Well, it was, I'd say in the spring of 45. They were liberating those camps as they were going through. And we never had any real information of the extent of the German atrocities. We knew them as SOBs, as soldiers, you know what I mean? And in our own way, I think we took care of their soldiers. But nobody, at least the people I was connected with, never had any real knowledge of the extent of what had been going on.
So when you saw these liberated prisoners and you spoke with them, did you at that time,
see, a lot of them couldn't even speak English. And the only thing you could see that they were emaciated, they were terribly hungry, they were... And our troops would gather them up and send them back. See, I was in the forward front lines, and they didn't want to get our guys dirty, I guess, with those people. And they just, they took care of them, you know what I mean? We never really had a real feel for what was going on in regard to that. We helped to liberate Dachau, but what went on there, we really didn't.
When you say you helped to liberate?
Or when I say my outfit.
But you personally weren't involved?
No.
Do you know what your family knew about the war during those years that you were away? I mean, do you have any sense of what
they
knew?
To my knowledge, I really didn't know. I don't know. If they knew anything, they never communicated with me. I think most of the Jews in America didn't know what was going on. I don't think I'm an exception. And I think the soldiers knew even less than the people in Pittsburgh.
That's why I asked.
What?
That's why I asked you what you knew as a soldier. I mean, being there and...
No, I don't think we knew. I mean, whether this information was deliberately withheld or not, I don't know. But I... the only thing I knew was, like in England, we knew that there was anti-Semitism around.
Did you feel any anti-Semitism yourself at any time up until 1945, you know, from growing up and in your teen years or your young adulthood?
I really didn't.
So you really never experienced it?
Not any to any great extent, no. First of all, our family had a great number of friends. A lot of them were Irish Catholic friends. We had members of our family who were married into the Catholic. And they hardly would call me a dirty Jew. They may have thought of it, they never publicly said it.
But you had a sense, I mean, you referred to, you know, golf clubs or whatever, but you did have a
sense absolutely. Of absolutely. I knew that there was a cleavage between the Jew and the non-Jew. It was really obvious. Not only did you had to break the barrier between Jew and Jew, then you had to break the barrier between Jew and non-Jew.
So there were not many Jews in politics or in public life, let's say prior to 1945.
Well, there was there were some, but during the Depression, more and more Jews tried to get jobs in government because that was the only place they could turn to. They wanted to get jobs in the courthouse and city. There was a great number of Jews. But.
And then when you were discharged in 1945, you came back to Pittsburgh? And? You went back to law?
Well, I went back to two things. I went, basically, in order to, my father had died, and my sister was out of town, my brother was in India, and...
To the station?
Yeah. And so my first duty was to try to get our family, the holdings, in some kind of shape. So I went into that phase of my life first, and then I gradually shared it with them all.
When did you go back to law full time?
I never did go back to law full time. I always shared it with the real estate. And as a result, I became sort of an expert in real estate. In real estate law. And I was called upon to advise the University of Pittsburgh, I advised Carlisle College, advise some of the expansion on the north side. I became involved in a lot of public issues. I opposed the attempt to have an urban redevelopment in Oakland like they did in East Sobriety. In my opinion, they ruined East Sobriety and I didn't want them to ruin Oakland. So I was a big, strong guy that stopped the Oakland Witchfield in his tracks.
Could you elaborate on some other... in other things that you participate in terms of what you've done for the city?
Well, I was what they call an activist. I was called upon to try to restrain the ravishes of redevelopment. I mean, it didn't take anybody too bright to look at what was happening in East Liberty. What happened in up around Duquesne University, what happened in the north side. They were running wild. And they weren't thinking of people. As a result, I was the head of several organizations that tried to contain the random rape of the cities.
Could you tell us?
I was a devotee of Jane Jacobs, who wrote the famous book, The Life and Death of the American City.
Could you tell us what years and what organizations you did have then?
The organization I'm the proudest of is the Committee to Save Oakland from the Ravishes of Redevelopment.
And what year was that? In the U.S.?
I guess 1965.
Has that come to an end? I mean...
Oh, it's still...
It's still there?
Well, they've calmed down a great deal. Have you ever been to East Liberty?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what year they really redeveloped East Liberty. I actually lived in East Liberty once.
Well, it's not very pleasant now.
No.
And East Liberty was just terrible to get the people out there. It used to be a very pleasant place to live.
That's right.
It's not so today. The people up at the Hill District, the Duquesne University expansion, beautiful properties, beautiful homes, and people had a beautiful life. And, took it all away from me. North Side was almost as bad, if not worse. And they tried to do it in Oakland. And I guess we were the, we actually went to Congress and stopped the whole program for Oakland.
To the state Congress?
What?
To state Congress?
No, federal.
Oh,
I spent many a day in Brooklyn with congressmen. And I was fortunate to get the ear of the committee chairman. We made them back off. And David Lawrence wasn't real happy with me either, because he and my father were partners in various ventures. He called me in one day, he says, "You know, we're doing this for your mother." I said, "Governor,